Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, April 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from CHP Berkshire, celebrating 50 years of healthcare, family support, WIC on food security, serving nearly 30,000 Berkshire residents, primary care, women's health, dental, and more. CHPBerkshires.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jennifer Miller. Dr. Miller specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation at Albany Med. She sees adult and pediatric patients for new or long-standing muscle, nerve, or tendon problems. She also aids in the rehabilitation needs of patients with amputation, spinal cord injury, stroke, brain injury, neurologic disease, and cerebral palsy. Get your calls in early, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us once again today is Dr. Jennifer Miller. Dr. Miller specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation at Albany Med. She sees adult and pediatric patients for new or long-standing muscle, nerve, or tendon problems. She also aids in the rehabilitation needs of patients with amputation, spinal cord injury, stroke, brain injury, neurologic disease, and cerebral palsy. Dr. Miller focuses on the use of exercises, modalities, medications, prescription equipment, and in-office procedures to help patients remain as active as possible, regardless of diagnosis, and when possible, avoid surgery. She completed her residency training at Harvard Medical School, Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, where she helped treat amputees who were survivors of the Boston Marathon bombing. And we'll talk about that for a moment or two in a minute. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Jennifer Miller, welcome back. It's been a while.
Great to be back, though. Thank you.
Yeah, the first time you were on, I think, was on April 15th, and that was the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing, and you played a kind of a key role.
Yes, I was here the week of the 10-year anniversary of the marathon bombing, which took place when I was a resident physician. So yeah. As a resident physician, you're very much submerged in whatever it is that your mentor for the month is doing. And it just so happened that after the marathon, I was on the amputee rotation at Spalding Rehab Hospital, which normally in a typical month would see two or three amputees, but we served all 19 of the amputees who were affected by the marathon bombing and many more who had other types of traumatic injuries.
I mean, that is experience that you can't expect to get when you're in your residency. That is once in a lifetime thing.
Absolutely. And one of the things that was abundantly clear to me when I was so submerged in that experience was that I didn't want that to be wasted on me. So when I started my position at Albany Med 10 years ago, I did a lot of outreach to the community to make sure that people knew that I was here to take care of amputee patients and that I wanted to have that lived experience and that unusual training by fire go to use and continue to serve others.
I mean, is there a way for you to quantify how it has made you a better person and a better doctor?
I mean, just since you say quantify, I think I asked Albany Med to run the numbers for me a couple years ago, and they said I had cared for at least 200 amputees in the capital region. And I feel like each is such an incredibly individualized case. But across the board, in order to become an amputee, you've had some kind of unexpected and traumatic thing happen to you, whether it's medical or it's a truly traumatic accident. But being able to bring all the nuance and all of the kind of emotional experience of the marathon bombing to the gravity of those conversations with each and every one of my patients, I think, has helped serve me well in serving others.
Dr. Jennifer Miller is our guest today, and you mentioned before the show that it is Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month. And you just said it, the amputee has dealt with, regardless of the circumstances leading up to it, tremendous trauma. Mm-hmm. So I assume that part of what you do, maybe even a big part, is focusing on psychological mm-hmm. well-being.
Absolutely. I mean, there is certainly such a kind of whole person and whole family experience that goes into that. And while we're talking about the medical symptoms of the way someone is managing their limb, in any interaction, we're also talking about where they are in their kind of grief experience or where they are in that recovery experience. And part of the kind of exciting umbrella of being a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist is we're also always looking ahead of how can we get someone back to the activities that make them feel like themselves? What kind of mobility is the baseline that they look forward to? And what's that goal that we need to get them back to?
The number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org with your question as well. So you also mentioned that the disability curriculum at the medical school has expanded. Explain.
Yeah. So for the past 2 years, I've been building, along with a lot of other colleagues' support throughout the medical school, something called our disability curriculum. And at the cornerstone of this curriculum is bringing in patients who have lived experiences with all different types of disabilities to interface with our students in different ways at different points in their curriculum, so that regardless of what specialty they go into, whether they become a colorectal surgeon or an OBGYN or a physical medicine rehabilitation doctor, that they bring that lens of how to best care for patients who may present with a disability and offer a thoughtful approach to their care.
Okay, so give me an example of how you're looking through this lens and you're changing your approach to care.
So one of the things we do is in their clinical skills curriculum, which is the class that is peppered throughout their entire curriculum to help them learn their doctoring skills. So how to listen with a stethoscope, how to use, you know, an otoscope to look in someone's ear. We've also added to that having a workshop where we have patients who present in a wheelchair and they have an opportunity to figure out how to modify their physical exam when their patient presents to them in a wheelchair, and also learn what are the right circumstances to have that patient transfer out of their wheelchair onto an exam table to make sure that they're given an equitable exam if they needed their heart listened to. You can best do that on a tilted table, so it wouldn't be reasonable to have someone stay in their chair. They should be transferred onto an exam table and appropriately examined at the correct angle, just as anyone else would. So helping everyone have that lens, and then while they're doing it, learning it from a patient themselves who can say, well, you know, when I go for my annual visit with my GP, this is what goes well, this is what could be better, and have that perspective brought in by someone who's lived it every day.
Do you have problems getting volunteers to come in and speak to the class?
I definitely don't have problems. I have a wonderful number of patients who have been very enthusiastic to be involved. At this point, I think we're up to 20 different patient self-advocates who have become involved in one way or another. We always have a little bit of suspense. So from a logistics perspective, me making sure that I have everyone there on time and ready for each of these workshops, right up until the last minute, there's a little degree of suspense. But we've pulled it off now several times, and I think it's a really valuable session.
What do you prefer, being an instructor or rolling up your sleeves and getting it done in the doctor's office?
Oh, I think they're absolutely complementary of each other. So when I am in the doctor's office, when I am seeing patients, I'm still very much an educator. I mean, when I have a student following me for the day, I'll say, get ready, you're going to learn a lot with me not looking at you, because I'm going to be educating my patients all day long. And as I'm educating my patients, that's also meant for you. So keep an ear out for what I'm saying, because what I'm teaching my patients, I also want you to take home from this as well.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Miller from Albany Med. She specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation. You know, you talk about this expanded disability curriculum and getting your young trainees to look through a lens in a little different way. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, as a layman, certainly not a doctor, that this should have always been happening. What happened to sort of put the light on? To sort of change the outlook of medicine?
It's a great question, and I resoundingly agree with you that it's long, long overdue, and certainly has had a very appropriate place for it for a very long time. And sometimes as we're teaching students about it, we're also going back in history to talk about the different points where various either legal actions or other parts of the disability history play into the way that care is received. But as far as specifically what has given it a platform in the last few years is Albany Med underwent something called a curriculum renewal, where we really went to the drawing board and looked at the entire way that we teach medical school and really recrafted the entire experience to be as modern and kind of appropriate for the times as possible. And this was a cornerstone of when we reformatted the curriculum.
Dr. Jennifer Miller is our guest. I tell you what, let's take a quick break here, Zach the engineer, and then we'll check the email bag and the phones. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington and Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox, injections, fillers, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery. BerkshirePlasticSurgeons.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Garden Center, Cheshire, offering landscape and design services, installation of trees, sod and lawn, stone walls, patios, and more. WhitneysFarm.com. The Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, presenting Wednesday night swing dancing, Wednesday nights with lessons and live music. Information at thelinda.org. And Berkshire Orthopedic Associates, presenting a webinar on hip replacement, Tuesday, May 6th at 4 p.m., BerkshireHealthSystems.org for registration.
I found the new baby. There's Sonny Rollins here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Jennifer Miller joins us today. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Joe in Ulster County writes in, Dr. Miller, can physiatry offer help for migraines? Mine stem from the position of my neck or shoulders when sitting in a reclined chair or lying down 95% of the time. Though I've had migraines since I was a teenager, I got whiplash twice many years ago. Believe the headaches increased then. I visited several neurologists about this, but none of them ever seemed to address my neck and shoulder involvement. Does physiatry address this? And that's from Joe in Ulster County.
Yes, Joe. So that's an excellent question. And you point out a very important point, which is that the lens through which physiatry looks at something like migraines might be a little bit different and a little bit complementary to the way it's been examined by neurologists in the past. As a physiatrist, thinking about the specifics of someone's migraines, we would look at things like posture and exercise routine or lack of exercise routine, and if it was appropriate, recommend things like neck or shoulder girdle strengthening. So if you picture the muscles between your shoulder blades, they can play a really important part in the posture of the neck, and then downstream from that, the posture of the muscles that are being penetrated by the nerves that are headed to the back of the head, and those are often a trigger when it comes to migraines. So if you haven't, connecting with a physiatrist on the specifics of your case could be very high yield.
Our number is 800-348-2551, and our guest is Dr. Jennifer Miller, who now it turns out, I figured out that she comes to the show every time around this year, for the last 3 years in a row. Ed writes in, what's the quadricep exercise that's easiest on the knees?
That's a good question because, as you allude to, Ed, the quadriceps are connected to the top of the kneecap. And so while they're a very important muscle to strengthen, they also affect the mechanics of the knee. And in someone who might have developing knee arthritis or other knee symptoms, they have to be careful about not overdoing it. So, I mean, squats are typically thought of as a muscle or as a way of strengthening the quads, but those are usually too tough on someone who has knee pathology. Might be worth looking at other approaches to more gently involving that, such as using a leg press machine at initially a pretty low setting, or cycling can also be a good way of engaging the quadriceps in a dynamic motion.
This email from Janet, then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you have a question for Dr. Jennifer Miller today, Janet writes, any exercises that can help with TMD? Temporomandibular joint disorder.
TMJ is the joint that is at the connection of the jawbone to the face. Quick aside that relates this to kind of physiatry in general, and is a fun fact in the nerdy world of physiatrists, is that often when you have joint pain, there's a possibility that it's connected to the joint above it and the joint below it. So if you're thinking about the knee pain we were just talking about with the quadriceps, it's also worth investigating that there's not a hip problem or an ankle problem that are actually sending the symptoms to the knee. And the reason I bring this up when it comes to TMJ is sometimes TMJ is getting symptoms from the neck, because the next closest joint to the jawbone is the neck. So if it hasn't been investigated, making sure that there's not a neck problem causing TMJ symptoms would be one avenue of investigating that further. And then when it comes to just the TMJ joint itself, I would suggest, if it hasn't been done already, working with a physical therapist who has familiarity with that area of the body could be quite helpful. But I imagine the program would also include some neck strengthening, because if the neck isn't working so hard on the positioning of the face and jaw, then that joint has an opportunity to carry less tension. But that's a very, very common area of the body for a lot of us to hold a lot of tension and cause ourselves pain.
How does one do neck strengthening? You can't really lift weights with your head. I mean, how do you do it?
Correct. So different ways. Sometimes people will do something like a jaw thrust, or they'll be, if you picture like standing with your back up against a wall and trying to push the back of your head into the wall, you're engaging your neck muscles in order to create that motion. And then if it's appropriate for the particular type of neck diagnosis someone has, they might do rotational exercises where they're turning the neck in a certain way, sometimes against a little bit of resistance, to build some strength through there.
Interesting. Getting back to Joe's question for a minute about the knee, and I believe arthritis was mentioned. At a certain age, does everybody have it?
So arthritis has a few different factors involved. So part of it is, as you're alluding to, it's key to the human aging experience, that at some point will the aging body accumulate wear and tear of the joints? Across the board, yes. And then there's a genetic component where some people's families just have a higher propensity for arthritis. And then there's bread and butter osteoarthritis, the wear and tear arthritis that I think we're talking about right now. But superimposed on that, there's other types of autoimmune arthritis, things people typically see rheumatologists for, although oftentimes physiatry can be helpful in caring for those diagnoses as well in parallel with the rheumatologist. So there are a number of different ways that arthritis can pop up, but there's definitely a rehabilitation lens through which to look at arthritis care.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Miller. It's physiatry on the program. 800-348-2551 is the number. And we'll grab one more email here, and then we'll hit the phones. This is from Jim. My daughter had an operation to repair a cavernous malformation. What is the expected outcome for this operation? Jim's not sure of the spelling, and I'm not sure of the pronunciation. Currently, she's chair-bound and needs assistance to transfer from bed to chair, receiving physical therapy once a week for 45 minutes. Any thoughts? You can look at this, but he even puts spelling question mark in there. No.
So I'm not positive of the exact operation you're referring to, or even what exact part of the body we're talking about. But I'll just say generally, I mean, it's good that there's physical therapy that's taking place. My initial gut reaction is that once a week might be too little, and that the more activity under the supervision of a physical therapist or a trained person who is helping someone get back to mobility, but in a very conscientious way, is an important part of recovery from any surgery.
All right, Jim, tell you what, man, if you're listening, call up the show and then you can explain what it is, because the doc and I, we're not exactly sure what the procedure is. I think it could be spelling, could be my pronunciations. 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Jennifer Miller. Let's go to Broad Alban. Bob, you're on.
Oh, thank you. 25 years ago, I underwent a left leg amputation. It was the result of a surgical attempt to clean out an artery of my left leg. I developed sepsis. I initially used OxyContin, 40 milligrams, and now I use 600 milligrams of gabapentin. And now I'm discovering that the gabapentin is not doing the usual clearing of the pain for the left leg as it once did. I usually have twice a month episodes of 3 days or more. Now the question turns to, is there a better now approach to dealing with the pain that I'm experiencing? This is created by the brain. And so is there anything new with respect to this pain episode?
Yes. Yeah, so
phantom pain.
Okay.
Yeah. So phantom limb pain is a multifactorial process. There's thoughts, exactly like you said, that there is an element that comes from the brain. So there is a part of the brain that is mapped out to provide information on the sensation from a limb. So when the limb is not there anymore, that area of the brain needs to repurpose its energies, and oftentimes it gets very stuck on the sensory experience of the limb that's not there. The same is true in the spinal cord as well. The spinal cord has areas where it can either amplify or decrease the pain experience, and sometimes that gets amped up after an amputation, so that not only is there the pain experience taking place, there's also something turning up the volume on the pain experience in the spinal cord. And then lastly, the severed nerve where the actual surgery took place, somewhere in there is the nerve endings that were cut, and those will sometimes develop over time to become more enlarged and more complicated, and that can form something called a neuroma, which is the angry nerve tissue at the very end of the severed nerve. So the brain, the spinal cord, and the neuroma, all three of them can be part of the phantom limb pain experience, and that experience can shift and change over time. And that changing experience could be, if the neuroma was developing or changing, that's something that could be investigated with a physiatrist in the context of a visit. And then sometimes the medications that are used to change the experience in the brain and spinal cord either stop working over time, you can develop a tolerance to them, or they can stop being as potent as they used to. Gabapentin is a more direct approach than the OxyContin, because the OxyContin would quiet down the receptors but not change that pain experience, which is why in more recent years we've pivoted to tools like gabapentin, which actually change the nerve signaling and make the nerve quiet down chemically. But if the gabapentin is not working as well as it once did, there are cousins of that medication, and it's possible that with your doctor, a pivot to a cousin of gabapentin might be prudent at that point.
Bob, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Miller is our guest. Gabapentin is an interesting one because it comes up in the pets and vet shows that we do. The vets use it often. And as I understood it, they use it to sort of calm down pets.
Mm-hmm.
And what exactly does it do, and how does it limit pain in humans?
So the understanding of it that I have, that I've picked up from snippets over time, but hopefully is representative of the answer. I don't pretend to be an expert on the veterinary space.
Well, no,
but
we'll stick with the humans for this one. Yeah.
But it was originally designed to be a seizure medication. And so the way that it works is on sodium channels within the brain and nervous system. And so it decreases how much sodium is traveling across the membrane of those nerves, and in doing so kind of quells angry tissue. And so when it comes to phantom limb pain, that means that it can quell that revved up nervous system tissue that's causing that pain experience. When it comes to other types of neuropathy or traumatic nerve damage, it's doing the same thing. And then it is used sometimes, especially in younger patients, sometimes pediatric patients, for things like nervous system irritability. So if a child had like a brain injury at a very young age and is just very irritable on a chemical level, it's used in that context. So I imagine that's probably the most similar to its application in cats and dogs.
Oh, very interesting. You know, as I understand your bio and what you do as a physiatrist, your number one go-to is always going to be physical therapy and exercise. When is that not indicated? When do you have to go to the next step for medication or whatever?
Yeah, so the physical therapy and exercise piece is always kind of the filter we run things through, and we're also meeting someone where they're at. So if they've already been doing 2 years of physical therapy and it hasn't worked for them, okay, it's time to pivot to something else. There is a handful of diagnoses where that's not my first suggestion. In fact, I have reason to believe in that small subset of things, it'll make things worse. So being able to identify and filter that is a really important kind of thing to pick up on. And oftentimes we're starting that in conjunction with something else. So I'll be recommending what activity or what physical therapy or what type of movement related next step there is, but also what medication do we start. And key to any of my visits is always the education piece of helping someone understand what it is that they're dealing with better. Because even if we can't make a tremendous change to a very chronic set of symptoms, understanding them better is empowering, and someone can move forward feeling differently about a problem if they understand it better.
As I understand it, and thankfully I've not had to deal with chronic long-term pain, but once you start with the meds, it can be a very slippery slope, right? In other words, sometimes you just can't get away from them.
Yeah. So one of the things that as medical providers, we have to be very attuned to is the right circumstances for different medications, the right thresholds to recommend when they're used, and then the right expectation management around, well, what are we going to use this medication for as far as is it to recover from this surgery and the goal is to be off of it in 3 weeks, or are we going to keep this on board as a tool in our toolbox when things are really bad, but the goal is not to use it every day, and being frank and upfront about what those goals are going to be. Coming back to the physical therapy for just a minute, I have just a story in my head from a recent patient encounter where I had a patient come in who had some medical background himself, and from the very first consult said to me, well, physical therapy doesn't work. And I said, oh, well, I would love to change your mind about that. And in this instance, he was coming in for frequent falls. And I said, well, we need to do a very specific kind of physical therapy where we focus on balance and the way you walk and widening your base of support so you can fall less often. And he just came back to me recently and said, all right, fine, you made a believer out of me. I'm falling less because I went and I actually worked on it. So that was a fun convert.
True or false? Doctors are the worst patients.
Very, very likely true.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back. Remember we talked about Jim's email?
Yes.
Jim's now on the phone. Smart man. Jim is in Pittsfield. Jim, go ahead.
Yes. What the condition was is a cavernous malformation. What it is is a series of blood vessels at the top of the spine. And it's sort of like a hemorrhage.
Oh, okay.
And it caused her to become paralyzed from the neck down, basically.
Sorry.
Her first bout, she recovered, and she was able to walk out of the facility, rehabilitation hospital. But then she had another one. And then finally, we found a doctor in Boston that operated on it.
So what was the, I'm sorry, I don't have the email in front of me. What was your question though, Jim?
Is it possible she is going to be able to recover with extensive physical therapy? I know what she's getting now is not enough. And of course, insurance doesn't want to pay for more.
Well, that's another show, and that's a very important point.
What do you think, Doc? So thank you for clarifying, because exactly like you explained, cavernous malformations can happen at different points in the body and have very different consequences depending on where they mm-hmm. actually occur. So in the cervical spine, causing quadriplegia or weakness of all four limbs below that area, it's hard to know without a little more granular detail about what her exam is like. But generally speaking, with that kind of injury, there's usually at least an 18-month period of an educated we don't know, where there is potential for that mm-hmm. nervous system to have improvements and for connectivity to, in some cases, improve. And you're exactly right. Having good physical therapy and activity support during that time is crucial. But what one's symptoms are right away compared to what one's symptoms are at the 18-month mark is how someone could give you a much better and more accurate prognosis yeah. for the big, big picture. But I imagine if this hasn't already happened for your daughter, someone like a physiatrist would do something called an ASIA exam, which is a very specific way of evaluating the nervous system function using just a physical exam, an old-fashioned, you know, doctor's exam. But the outcome of that ASIA exam gives us the most detailed information on what to expect as far as recovery.
Jim?
No, it would be an ASIA exam.
Yep, that's the type okay. of spinal cord injury exam that we do to help predict what someone's recovery might look like.
Explain a little bit of, and Jim, thank you for the call. Explain a little more about the ASIA exam. You said it's old school.
Yeah, so the ASIA exam is the American Spine Injury Association's standardized way of evaluating a patient who's had some kind of injury to their spine. So if someone presents with paralysis of both their legs or with quadriplegia, paralysis of all four limbs, what the physiatrist or the neurosurgeon, or there's a number of different specialties of medicine that'll do this very particular exam, we measure strength at five different joints of the arm, or five different muscle groups of the arm, five different muscle groups of the leg. And then we test sensation first using a cotton swab and then using a pinprick to use two different testings of the nervous system. And we do that for every dermatome of the body or every area of the body that a nerve potentially goes to. So it
How
ends up being like 34 different times.
Oh, wow.
So it's a very tedious physical exam. But once that exam is completed, there's very specific information about whether or not the injury is complete or incomplete, so whether there's connectivity below where in the spinal cord was injured, and then whether that connectivity includes sensory function, so the way we feel things, versus motor function, the way we are able to use muscles. And putting all that information together lets someone like a physiatrist make much more informed statements about prognosis, about someone's ability to walk again.
Very interesting. So a couple quick questions, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number, or voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. Our guest is Dr. Jennifer Miller. So on this Asia test, first of all, you pinprick,
mm-hmm.
and then you use a swab, and you say there is a qualitative difference?
So what you're doing in each spot, you do a whole series with just a cotton swab, and then you do the whole series again with a pinprick, is you're differentiating, can the patient feel it at all? Can the patient feel it normally, or do they feel it but it's abnormal? And so based on that criteria, it gets rated as a 0, a 1, or a 2.
How can you tell if it's abnormal, if it's inside the person? That's a not a subjective thing, but you're not experiencing.
Yeah, so the patient's reporting this back to you. So in many cases, when someone has a spinal cord injury, cognitively, they're able to be having a conversation with you and reporting back. So you're going through with them saying, you know, I just touched here, do you feel that? Or sometimes you're making it so they're not able to see what you're doing, and you're asking them whether or not they feel anything at a given time, and then correlating that with whether you're touching that area or not. And from that, you can deduce if maybe the perception is inconsistent or the perception is somewhat there, then you might rate that as a 1. But if they report normal consistently, that would be a 2. And if they don't seem to feel anything, that would be a 0.
I'm sorry for the questions about testing, but I'm just a geek, and this, I find this interesting. Then you have this data,
mm-hmm.
and you put it in presumably some sort of a model, and then you know this is the outcome we can expect. Does AI come into this at all? Can you put these numbers in and get a more distant prediction?
I imagine so. So this is actually decades old information that I learned in the context of my residency and was doing, for instance, when I was at Spalding on the spinal cord injury unit for a different month of my training, was doing this on a daily basis with patients. Now as an outpatient physiatrist taking care of patients who oftentimes were injured many years ago or sometimes decades ago, it's something I get asked to do maybe once or twice a year. But for those who are newly injured and newly having those computations made, I have to imagine there's a more sophisticated, probably AI-driven answer these days.
Well, when there's no baseline, and last question about this, I promise, and then we'll take a break. 800-348-2551. When there's no strength baseline for joints, mm-hmm. how are you quantifying it?
So there kind of is a strength baseline for joints.
For a patient you've never seen before?
To a certain extent, yes. So most adults who don't have any kind of muscle diagnosis, to the extent that I can make predictions from their age and maybe their gender, I know what muscles to use in myself to test against their muscles. So if I, for instance, ask someone to flex their biceps and I'm going to test the strength of their biceps, a healthy person should be able to fully resist their biceps with my biceps. So I'm going to position myself in such a way that I'm
Well, maybe you're wicked strong, as we say.
Well, but the idea is that they can give enough resistance that there's no motion. Whereas when it comes time, for instance, for them to rotate their forearm, I might pair that against my biceps so I can put myself at a mechanical strength advantage. So like when I was in training, at one point we were doing exams for the Patriots, so the football players. I have to be very clever about how to position my skinny little body so that I can test against football players' biceps. But there are ways to modify your physical exam to make yourself as effective as possible to get that information.
Aren't you glad you came?
Indeed.
Yeah, let's take
Always
a break.
Fun.
800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Miller's our guest today. We'll get back to the phones and the emails in a moment.
Oh,
Zappa. 800-348-2551. That's the number. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Dr. Jennifer Miller, a physiatrist at Albany Med and a teacher of young people, which is very nice. You got the next round of brilliant medical minds coming. You ever see kids at the school and just say, that one's not going to make it?
No, I definitely have had to calibrate, even in my 10 years of doing it, for kind of shifts and changes in the med school population. When I first started, it was like, oh, I could have babysat some of these kids. And now it's right at the edge of like, oh, I could have been their parent, but teen parent, but still. So calibrating for changing ages. But no, I can't say, okay, I think that way.
Because, you know, we have young people who work here too. And every time we get a new one, I realize how ancient I am. It's amazing. I mean, they don't even know how to cut tape, these kids today. You know what I mean?
I did mention to a student recently that I thought somebody looked like John Travolta, and they just looked at me like, who is that?
Well, listen, get used to it. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Are there any vitamin mineral supplements that would help with aging muscular atrophy?
So are there any supplements? So I don't tend to recommend a lot of supplements, with one exception. I do have a lot of patients who will tell me that they benefit from the anti-inflammatory properties of turmeric. So in the right circumstances, folks who are dealing with arthritis or other conditions that are characterized by inflammation, sometimes that can be a natural way of treating it that is very helpful to some. And then outside of that, I'm thankful for naturopaths and others who are looking through the lens specifically of supplements and kind of other remedies, because as a medical provider, I tend to be more in the realm of FDA-approved medications and then the other types of treatments we've talked about.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting way you phrase that about naturopaths. Does that mean that you're grateful that they look into stuff, but you're not really using that information?
So I have a not negligible number of patients who have dealt with very, very, very chronic conditions. So folks who had something happen to them 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think appropriately, when you've been dealing with pain, especially for 30 years, you want to leave no stone unturned. Yeah. So when folks are inclined to get the input of experts who are looking at it through a complementary lens, I think that's a great thing to be adding additional information. But what I don't like to do is pretend to be an expert at something I'm not an expert at. So the array of different supplements and other things like that, that is kind of outside the realm of how I was trained and how I approach problems. I'm thankful when there's other experts to complement my input.
There you go. Well, I see a lot of ads for a lot of supplements, and frankly, I think if I take them all, I'm going to live forever. And my mind will always stay sharp.
Get back to me on that hypothesis.
Okay. Let's go to Diane in Williamstown. Diane, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm not sure how to ask this question. I guess I'll just blurt it out and you can tell me I shouldn't be asking it. I'm wondering about getting appointments or are you taking patients? How do a person go about that?
All right, we've got to be very careful about this. There are certain call to action rules about public radio.
I know it. That's why I asked the person who took the phone call to see if I could do this. And asked for an appointment with Dr. Jennifer Miller, would that work?
So if you visit Albany Med's website and look up Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, that's how you would access the contact information for the physiatrists that work there.
All right. Hey, Diane. So it's Albany Med, right? The website, albanymed.org. Albanymed.org. Diane, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Rick is in Claverick. No, that's a dead Rick, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
So I have a wife that's been a lifelong horsewoman. She's 62 years old, and she's loaded with arthritis. If she rides too much these days, her hips bother her. She recently just had her right shoulder replaced because she was loaded with arthritis. And her hands kill her from the arthritis. And the problem is, she's a three-time survivor of breast cancer, and they won't give her the normal arthritis medications. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestion that she may be able to get some relief with her hands.
Yes, yeah, so I would check with her physician first, but sometimes when other medications are limited when it comes to arthritis, the turmeric I was mentioning previously can be a more natural approach to inflammation and can be a helpful tool. Sometimes specific to hand arthritis, there's also what we call modalities, which is something physiatrists are expert at prescribing, which are different passive treatments to the body to help with symptom relief. So this can be things like paraffin wax dips for the hands, and that would be done with an occupational therapist. So if she had a physician who could recommend occupational therapy, they might be able to use different types of treatments to help control symptoms in that way. And another kind of the physical medicine part of physical medicine and rehabilitation actually refers to different ways of taking care of the body using non-medical treatments. So that can even be things like heat and cold. So sometimes alternating between moist heat and cold can be useful for things like arthritis management.
Do you know why that works?
So a few different ways. So the cold component is decreasing.
The ice is her best friend with her recovery from the shoulder. So.
Absolutely, because that's decreasing swelling, and then both of them are changing the nerve perception as well by the gabapentin we were talking about earlier, changing the way the nerve signaling is happening by kind of making it calibrate to hot and calibrate to cold again. It gives it an opportunity to kind of reset.
All right, Rick.
Okay.
Hey, man, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Paraffin wax dips.
Mm-hmm.
What on earth is that going to do?
So the idea there is that you have the physical heat we were just talking about, but in that particular way, it's more penetrating into the joints and bones. So instead of just like soaking your hand in warm water, when it's done in paraffin, it's thought to make a deeper penetration into the tissue so that the heat is experienced more intensely but safely.
Mm, and this is just heat. So in other words, if you put medication in this paraffin, it would not get to the source of the pain?
So there's a different treatment that's also done by occupational therapists called iontophoresis, which is where there's a medication that's applied to the skin and then pulses of either ultrasound or other types of modalities are used to make it penetrate deeper into the joints.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop on WAMC.org. Kevin in Greenfield writes, on February 18th, I woke up not being able to bend my right leg. No previous event. After an X-ray, I was diagnosed with patellar femoral arthritis. An MRI showed a torn meniscus. They are different, correct? With the current healthcare situation in the world, the scope will be more than 2 months after the original X-ray. Ridiculous, in my opinion. And that's from Kevin in Greenfield.
So as far as the question part of that there, yes, the patellofemoral joint is the back of the kneecap as it articulates with the knee itself, and that can be an area where we can get arthritis. And when that arthritis flares up, it can cause locking out of the joint like you experienced. And you're right, that's a totally different system than the meniscus tear, which the meniscus is the shock absorber of the knee, the part of the knee that has the femur bone, the upper leg bone, as it connects to the tibia bone, the lower leg bone. Where those two bones connect, you need the shock absorption of the meniscus. And when the meniscus is torn and that shock absorption is disrupted, it can cause a lot of pain and a lot of restriction of the knee and sometimes can be repaired with arthroscopy. But yes, those are two separate things.
All right. And what you don't want to comment on his 2 month delay to get the X-rays and everything else?
Not really. Okay. I mean, that is the
good answer. Just leave it be. We'll leave that for it. All right, Kevin, thanks for the email. Elizabeth writes, what are the best types of exercises and activities to help maintain good physical ability and delay use of medications for someone with Parkinson's disease?
So before we added the Parkinson's disease part, my answer to just exercise in general is the best exercise is the one that you'll stick with or the one that you like, because we can all have great intentions, but if we're not actually doing it, it doesn't matter what the best exercise is.
True.
Specific to Parkinson's, Parkinson's definitely benefits from concentrated efforts on balance. And
go ahead, you can have a drink of water. I'll give the time. My gosh, it's 2:53. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Miller, and the number is 800-348-2551.
Thank you.
What are you drinking, booze there? That was quite a reaction. You all right?
Nah, I'm good.
All right.
So yeah, specific to Parkinson's, one of the things that happens over time is the gait can become more narrow-based and there can be an increased risk of falls. So working on motion, working on balance, there's actually a very specific physical therapy.
Okay, you're all right. You know what? This happens from time to time on my program, and sometimes the guest will get a little verklempt. It's fine. You know what? We move through it. Dr. Jennifer Miller will see you soon, and she's going to be okay. She specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation at Albany Med. Are you alive, doctor? All right. Remind me to show you the cough button before the next show. There is one there.
Yes. So, yes, apologies.
No sweat.
So there is actually a very specific protocol to help people with Parkinson's maintain their mobility. And
oh, have another swig. Just go ahead. The show's almost over. Come on. She's got a little frog in her throat, Zach. Oh, Zach is... Uh-oh. We don't need the Heimlich, Zach. It's fine. All right, go ahead.
So I specifically would recommend asking to be connected with a physical therapist familiar with that.
Zach is holding up some cough drops. No, I think it's fine, Zach. You know what? This happens to me at least twice a show, so I'm not, we're in the same boat here, Doc. Anyway, what were we talking? Oh, Parkinson's. That's right.
Yeah, so there's a specific protocol of exercises. It has an acronym that I'm drawing a blank on in this particular moment, but they will work specifically on balance and helping someone stay as mobile as possible.
Your headphones broke, too, during that. Okay, let's just move on. Why don't we have a call, and then the caller will talk a little bit. See that button that says mute? If you hold that down, you can guzzle some water while our next caller, Jeff, asks a question. Jeff, you have a minute to ask a question. Go ahead.
Hi. I had minimally invasive spine surgery 11 years ago to correct spinal stenosis, and I was hoping it would fix my drop foot. It didn't. Then I had a procedure called a tendon transfer on my foot, which was supposed to fix it too. It had some, it did work a little, but not much. I was just wondering if there's anything more I can do.
At any point, have you tried any kind of orthotic or insert into your footwear?
Yeah, I have a brace that I'm supposed to wear, but I don't like wearing it because it just interferes with my motion, and I don't know. I can do that, but I prefer not to.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
So, yeah, so it sounds like you've taken a surgical approach two different times and that the tendon transfer partially improved things but didn't remedy the situation. When that's the case, some of the other tools we think about, I mean, if it hasn't been done, sometimes strengthening exercises can get a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit more out of the tendon transfer surgery. And then as far as restoring clearance of the foot during the gait cycle, there are different types of bracing technology that can help that. And if you have a brace that you don't really like, I'd urge you to check out other options because there's a lot of different technology out there. And sometimes it's a case of finding a better brace that can be a better tool to support your walking.
All right, Jeff. Thanks a lot. Now, drop foot is what? What is that?
Drop foot is, there can be many different causes of drop foot, but that's where the muscle that is supposed to activate during the swing phase of gait cycle. So when you pick when you pick up your foot, you have to bend at the ankle so that your foot doesn't drag on the ground. And if it's not able to do that, the toes will catch and you'll drag your foot. And that's what drop foot is.
Let me ask you a quick question. How much do you want this show to end right now?
I am torn because I am having a delightful time, but my vocal cords are not agreeing with
you. You know what? As far as I'm concerned, Dr. Miller, you have passed the most rigorous test because what do you do in that situation? You press on. So you get bonus points. You know, we really didn't talk much, and maybe next time you're on, we'll talk, since it's limb loss and limb difference awareness month, talk about the advances in prosthetics, which we ordinarily would get to, and we didn't. We got right into the calls. So I apologize for that.
Not
but,
at all.
You know, maybe next time.
Absolutely.
You have a lozenge, you come back on the show, yeah?
Absolutely.
All right, so if people want to find out more about your program, how do they do that online?
So as we were mentioning before, I can go to
The website.
The Albany Med website. Physical medicine and rehabilitation is our department, and they should find a lot of information there to direct me, to direct them to myself and to my colleagues.
You hear that music? Your long suffering is over. Good job. Dr. Jennifer Miller, thanks for being on the show. Sorry about the headphones breaking on you during the show.
Not at all.
Snapping in half.
That was fun dramatic. This was not.
Okay, right. Well, we're going to do the underwriting now. We're still on, so don't swear. Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwangunks. Their education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency wait list available. Woodland Pond. NP.org. Let me tell you something. Dr. Jennifer Miller of Albany Med is a trooper, and she got through this show, and I'm a fan. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who is our engineer. Barb King screened the calls, including the one who wanted to, you know, do some business with Dr. Miller, but that's okay. Tomorrow, we'll talk antiques with Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas. If you got something you think is worth something, they'll be here to tell you it's not. We'll see you at 2:00.